From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Could have gone to a lot of different places, but we'll start here. Our connection this hour was made yesterday by the Associated Press with this bombshell of a headline. Before Trump job, Manafort worked to aid Putin. Paul Manafort was Donald Trump's campaign manager from March through August of last year. And in July, the Republican National Committee removed language in its platform supporting Ukraine in dealing with Russian incursions. It looked like a clear move to please or appease Russia. The AP's report provides evidence that beginning in 2005, Paul Manafort was making $10 million a year doing all kinds of work to help Vladimir Putin. Manafort has denied the allegation, and yesterday, White House spokesman Sean Spicer said that Donald Trump didn't know what Paul Manafort got paid to do for Russia 10 years ago. So how did Manafort try to help Putin in Russia? According to the AP report, Manafort worked to influence politics, business deals, even news coverage inside the United States to benefit Russia. But how about trade? There's a lot more than just one international headline we're going to be following during this hour. Let's talk a little bit about trade. There's a real anti-globalism sentiment and anti-free trade vein running through not only the new White House, but pulsing across Europe. Leaders at the European Union have discussed pressing ahead with free trade pacts despite growing protectionist tendencies. And our guests can discuss this and a lot more this hour. In fact, they're here in the studio right now because there's an exhibit opening tonight that we're going to tell you all about in just a moment. Dr. Randy Stone has helped organize this. He's the director of the Skolny Center for Polish and Central European Studies at the University of Rochester. Randy, welcome back to the program.
Thank you, Evan. Nice to be here.
And glad to have the Consul General of the Republic of Poland in New York. That's Maciej Golubiewski, who's with us here in studio as well. And Maciej, thank you for being here as well.
Thank you for having me.
Tonight at 7:30 at Rettner Hall at the University of Rochester is an exhibit opening. It's going to run for 3 days. And Randy, I'll start with you. And I think you both can share your thoughts on the exhibit tonight and what the theme is. Go ahead.
Well, thanks, Evan. The exhibit is on the Holocaust, which, of course, is a crucial and very painful part of 20th century history and world history. And it highlights a particular sort of paradoxical feature of this event, which was that at this time, which was one of the darkest times of our history, there was also amazing heroism that was called forth. And so it is dedicated to the families of Poles who have been commemorated in Yad Vashem, who gave their lives to try to save Jews during the Holocaust.
And there's a panel discussion tonight?
That's right. We'll have a panel that's in Morey Hall at the University of Rochester River Campus at 7:30. Morey Hall 321. That will go for about an hour, and then there will be a reception that's free and open to the public at the in Rettner Hall, where the exhibit is being shown.
What do you want people who are going to be out there tonight to not only listen to the panel but see this exhibit? What do you want them to take from it, Randy?
I guess I want them to understand that there is so much more to history than our shallow, stereotypical first takes, right? That there's tremendous amount of horror that happened during World War II, and yet human experience is not just horror. There were brave people who did amazing things, and that complexity, I think, is something that I'd like them to come to grips with.
Okay. Mr. Golubiewski, your thoughts on the exhibit?
This is a great exhibit. I think it shows a little bit more in a good light the contribution of Poland during the during the wartime, during the Second World War, to the question of saving Jews. We tend to forget oftentimes when you look at the Holocaust that Poland actually was the only country in Western Europe that you were punished by death and your family was punished by death if you decided to help Jews in any way whatsoever. And even because of and even with that, the number of the Polish righteous is the highest one in the Yad Vashem. So we kind of want to bring in, I'm representing Poland, obviously. So
sure.
Brag a little bit about our quite unique contribution to Polish Jewish to good Polish Jewish relations during that period of war.
I think bragging is okay, particularly because as Dr. Stone says here, sometimes we simplify history. And we erase parts of history or at least gloss over parts of history. Why don't we know more about these contributions? Why do you think that is?
Why we don't know
yeah,
more?
Why don't we know more about this?
I think, you know, during the, well, I think the reasons are simple. One is that after 45, a lot of contemporary history was just basically hidden, both from Poles and from the rest of the world, from the West. I mean, we had the Cold War, we had the Iron Curtain. Very little research was being done, very little investigation was being done in the past. The people who helped the Jews oftentimes were part of the resistance that was also victim to the communist oppressors in Poland, the Stalinists, the ones who collaborated with the Soviets in Poland, and they were afraid of talking about it. Żegota, which is, I think, one of the few, if not only, movement in Europe at the time who was an organization that was helping the Jews in an organized manner. You know, people there were from the so-called Home Army, the only well-organized underground government and army in occupied Europe at the time, who, if they went public with all sorts of information like this, would be punished and put in prison in the 50s and 60s. So really, that was one of that was just that. The second one is that, you know, Poles after 1989, you know, have not focused so much on their history. They focus on developing their kind of daily lives, you know, bringing, developing the market economy, just kind of starting living a normal life. And certain things, you know, were just kind of a little bit, you know, put up on a back burner. You know, we'll deal with history and our past. People wanted to, you know, talk about the future.
Sure, understandable. And you should see that Maciej has a pin that he's wearing, a U.S. flag and a Polish flag,
yeah,
flying together. And one of the things that you've talked about in various stuff, we're going to talk about the work that you do, but whether you've been in Ohio or various places, you talk about shared values, mm-hmm, among the peoples. Can you tell me a little bit about that?
Look, I think of course, the United States is an extremely pluralist country. I mean, you have every nation on earth here. But one thing that we have to remember about Poland and the U.S. is that, you know, we've always been, I think, the attachment to patriotism and this kind of idea of a bit of exceptionalism. Victor Hugo once said that there are two countries in Europe that really matter. It's France and Poland. Why? Because France defends the culture, Poland defends the civilization and defends, you know, basically the borders. And we've been, you know, the rampart of Europe. And, you know, we did consider ourselves fighting for our freedom and our and theirs, meaning United States during the War of Independence with people like Kosciuszko and Pulaski. Also in Europe, in Belgium, we also helped a lot of during the Spring of Nations. We've been around, you know, fighting for other people's freedom. So we have this similarity of being patriotic, you know, with this tradition of always showing up where there was a good cause. And I think we are, I think on the kind of a traditional side, you know, we are still a relatively conservative society. I think by and large, the Middle America is more conservative than the average Western European part of Europe. And Poland is more like the U.S. You know, we have, you know, our church attendance is high, just like here. We are attached to family. We kind of, you know, we live our lives. There's, you know, we're attached to tradition, to customs, our habits. So, you know, things that are sometimes shocking to the Western Europeans, you know, we talk about the God, family, country, are not so shocking to Poles, you know, who are not afraid of speaking up like that.
The Consul General of the Republic of Poland in New York is Maciej Golubiewski, who is one of our guests for the hour. And your role, why don't you tell our listeners what your role is in the work that you're doing here?
The Consul Generals, just like Consul Generals of the United States in Poland, and there are there too, we represent Polish interests and interests of Poles abroad. While the embassy with our ambassador, represents officially the state of Poland in the U.S. and engages in federal level politics, you know, the consuls and the consul generals are there first to help Poles who are abroad. So we, you know, we issue passports, for example. We issue visas for those who want to come to visit us. We are basically an office, expat office of Poland outside of Polish borders. But what we also do, we help the embassy in its in diplomatic functions. So we further Polish-American relations in all fields, be it economic, business, educational, cultural. We inform the hosting state about what's happening in Poland. We're doing a lot of public diplomacy, try to tell Americans what's happening, how we see our relationships, you know, what's happening right now in Poland, and you know, doing a lot of public diplomacy with the larger public and local governments.
We have a question from a listener named John in Menden off air. He just wanted to know, have the pre-war Jewish populations in Eastern Europe recovered?
No. The level, the scale of the Holocaust was just so high that, you know, there's absolutely no way that the numbers could ever come up to that level. You know, in Poland we have thousands of Jews, we had millions, we had 3.5 million of Jews, which was the largest number in the world in a single country. Jews came because there was a relative tolerance in Poland at the time. They called it Poland, the promised land for the Jews. You know, they're gone, and it's just a matter now that there's also Israel, you know, so there is no country to go to. If you really want to feel safe and be Jewish, you don't go to Poland right now, you go to Israel or to the United States and other liberal Western democracies, but not all. So it's just a matter of just the horrendous thing that happened to the Jewish nation.
Sure. Yeah. And once again, tonight, the exhibit, 7:30, and the panel discussion at 7:30 is where, Randy Stone?
It's in Morey Hall, which is right next to Rettner Hall on the main quad of the River Campus.
So the 7:30 panel discussion, and then they'll head over to Rettner Hall for a reception?
For a reception, that's
for
right.
For a reception. And
viewing of the exhibition.
And viewing of that exhibition. So that is tonight. We'll make sure that you've got more details before the end of the hour on that again. But as we move into some other subjects, you know, Randy, you couldn't come into the studio and not let me ask you about Paul Manafort. You know, Maciej's looking at me like, do you really want to do this? But look, when Dr. Stone's here and these things come up here, that was one of the bigger AP headlines. In fact, John Cassidy, a writer for The New Yorker, said that was the biggest AP headline he had seen in a decade. I guess we'll see what comes out of it. Paul Manafort, of course, is denying it. But you have somebody now who worked as the campaign manager for Donald Trump. During the RNC, we saw the language change about Ukraine. That looked fishy almost from the moment it happened. And now you have the AP digging up evidence that Paul Manafort was paid millions of dollars to basically lobby and promote Putin and Russia in this country, in Ukraine, tried to set up a media empire, didn't really work, but did all kinds of things here. What are the implications of this?
Well, one dot that I think needs to be connected here is that he was actually working for Russia, evidently, when he was serving as campaign manager for Viktor Yanukovych in Ukraine. So this is the dictator of Ukraine, who we all heard a lot about after the events in which the people came out on the streets and the military refused to fire on their own people, and he ended up fleeing to Russia, ushering in the new Ukrainian government. So that was a piece of the story that we didn't know, and that's pretty interesting that he was a paid agent of Russia at that point. He was also a paid agent of Russia, evidently, when he was very involved in American politics.
Interesting is one word you use for it. That might be a euphemism. What more do we need to see out of this before we can start to draw conclusions or be more concerned, I guess, here, Randy?
Well,
is this enough that we should start to draw some conclusions about this?
This is one report, right? I saw it in the Washington Post. Yep. This morning. I'm sure it will be vigorously denied and debated back and forth. This information is presumably going into the FBI investigation, which is ongoing, about the Donald Trump administration and its and the campaign and its connections with the Russian government. We also had a report that came out yesterday from the AP that indicated that the FBI had a lot more information than we had previously thought, and that this was a very suggested that they had human intelligence, that they had documentary evidence, that they had itineraries and evidence of meetings that took place. Now, between whom and at what time, we don't know. We also already know that Jeff Sessions, our attorney general, lied under oath to Congress about his contacts with Russians during the election campaign. So this is a developing morass for the Trump administration, and it remains to be seen where it goes. Mm-hmm. But I think it will dog him probably for quite some time to come. These investigations take a long time. I don't think that Congress is likely to act on it in any very effective way. But the other thing that happened yesterday was a very public rupture between the two ranking members of the House Intelligence Committee over this issue. So it's going to be a long story, I think.
Is it plausible when Sean Spicer says, look, Donald Trump didn't know who was paying Paul Manafort 10 years ago. So even if the report's true, Donald Trump didn't know. Is that plausible?
I think it's plausible that Donald Trump didn't know all sorts of things. Certainly, you should do due diligence about your employees when you hire them to be your campaign manager.
I guess if you don't know what the nuclear triad is, maybe you don't know what your campaign manager was doing 10 years ago.
Mm-hmm. I would be very interested to know how Paul Manafort got to be campaign manager. Mm. He was nominated by someone, suggested by someone, presumably by someone who Donald Trump trusts. And so what the connections are, the networks and so forth, this is all pretty opaque at this point. But there evidently are some pretty influential people who feel comfortable with very close ties with the Putin administration.
And looking a little bit more broadly, it was earlier this month that diplomats from six Eastern European countries met with some U.S. senators, Poland among those six countries, asking for American assistance in dealing with Russia's so-called hybrid warfare, cyber attacks, propaganda, threats of force. They see President Trump sort of smiling alongside Vladimir Putin, but they're concerned with how Russia continues to cause problems. I know that Consul General Golubevsky's focusing on other things, so it's unfair to put him in the spotlight with this kind of a question. He can comment if he wants, certainly. But Dr. Stone, for you, when you see that kind of a meeting saying, look, we need some help and, you know, Russia's influence is impacting us in these ways, what's the story there for you?
Well, I think there was a lot of trepidation about the Trump administration in Eastern Europe because of things that he said on the campaign trail. There was a lot of concern that Eastern Europe was just going to be abandoned to Russia.
Talk about NATO, you mean?
That we were going to walk away from our NATO guarantee, that the Article 5 guarantee might just be optional or might be something that was subject to bargaining. One of the concerns about this is that even if there were not a significant change of Trump's the U.S. foreign policy on this issue, just talking about it could create a credibility gap, right? Could make it more likely that Russia would be more adventurous than otherwise, right? Because that guarantee, which previously had seemed to be ironclad, was now subject to question. So I think that's the background to this, that everyone in Eastern Europe wants to get together and talk with the administration and be reassured, well, no, we didn't really mean those things that we said during the campaign. And I think that the administration has reassured them to some degree by appointing a bunch of pretty hard-line military advisors to some of the key foreign policy positions. All right. So with the exception of Rex Tillerson, the new
Secretary of State,
yeah. Who, of course, was CEO of Exxon before, all of the people who have been appointed to these sorts of positions have been generals who have expressed sort of strong support for the traditional American foreign policy.
Secretary Mattis as an example.
Right, for example.
Okay, so at least some reassurance there. And Consul General Golubevsky, how can you just speak generally about how maybe how polls and how you and how maybe some of the leadership views the early weeks and months of this administration? Is it getting off to a slightly more placid and easier, better start than some had feared during the campaign trail?
Sure, like Professor Stone just said. I mean, our big concern at the beginning of the administration was the security concern regarding Russia's meddling in its eastern neighborhood, western neighborhood. Sorry, and I think it's very clear right now that the decisions that have been made in the NATO during the NATO summit in July 2016 are being upheld. We are hosting now a few thousand German U.S. soldiers mm-hmm. on the Polish soil for the first time in history. America, the United States, is really living up to its commitment to have that presence under NATO in Poland. I think the initial threshold of trust has been crossed. We are happy that those commitments are upheld and they will be upheld. Another thing to mention, just personally, President Trump met with the Poles during the campaign, met in Chicago, and he made it very clear to them that he was impressed with the fact that Poles are really paying up the 2% of the GDP for NATO. And he was, and he's actually using Poland as an example.
He has, that's right.
And, I think it really made an impression on him, and I think he likes people who kind of live up to the deal. And I think I wouldn't be surprised if I don't think it was a singular factor, but I think, he considers Poland as a trusted ally in the NATO camp. And I think, our initial fears have got a bit pacified. And we are having, I know from Ministry of Foreign, Ministry of Defense is having an excellent relationship right now with the administration and foreign ministry and everyone else. I think we are off to a good start now.
Okay, we're going to pivot to trade in a moment, but I go back to January. This is the CNN headline. Poland welcomes thousands of U.S. troops in a NATO show of force. Some 4,000 U.S. soldiers were deployed as part of troop rotations to Europe that the Pentagon has said are intended to bolster ties with NATO allies and send a clear message to Russia. Russia responded by criticizing the continuous deployments as a threat to Russian security. So, Dr. Stone, you have, as Mr. Golubiewski says, maybe the early weeks and months of the Trump administration, Poland feels like a real ally. They're pulling their weight on paying for NATO, which is something Donald Trump said during the campaign with some controversy, but Poland is doing that. He's meeting with them. He's holding them up as this example of an ally pulling their weight. But he's also trying to build a better relationship with Putin. And Russia is unhappy with this 4,000 U.S. soldiers here. Is this all sort of political theater? Or ultimately, where's the balance going to tip there?
Well, everything is ultimately going to depend on what happens in Ukraine. The conversations I've had with Russians about Ukraine suggest that the Putin administration may not be satisfied with the status quo. They may decide to push and try to revise it. The status quo right now is an ongoing civil war in Ukraine with many thousands of casualties. And if there is a push by Russia to advance a more dramatic revision of the status quo, perhaps changing the government in Ukraine, that probably will lead to a confrontation with the United States. Certainly, the majority in his own party would push Donald Trump in that direction. He seems to want to walk this tightrope of being friendly with Putin and still maintaining sort of traditional American concerns about borders and about sovereignty and so forth in Eastern Europe. But that may be a tightrope that's increasingly difficult to walk. And you can see the possibility for crises escalating, particularly if Putin decides to apply more pressure by putting pressure on the Baltic states. So that's where the sort of the credibility of the NATO commitment becomes important.
Sure. And before I grab a phone call, Mike and Aron, quite hang there. I'll come to you in just a second. Randy, you said during the campaign and after that there were legitimate reasons, even had he not been elected, that the rhetoric was going to damage NATO relations, Russian adventurousness, etc. Are you pacified at all in that concern right now?
I think it's still a very live concern that the fact that the issue was raised and that then Donald Trump was elected indicates that there is some uncertainty that we didn't think there was about the U.S. guarantee of the eastern borders of NATO. The Russians have been saying for years that they didn't really believe the Article 5 guarantee, or that it would, maybe it would apply to some countries, but not to others, right? Surely it wouldn't really apply to the Baltic states, right? Because they were part of our country, for goodness sake. Right. This is a very common opinion that would be expressed by Russian foreign policy experts who read English and are well informed about the American press. So if they think that, it seems likely that the people that they advise in the Kremlin think that, that there's a real question mark there. And so if there were a crisis, the possibility for misunderstanding about this is, I think, quite worrisome.
I was hoping you were going to make us feel better about that. Thanks a lot. Let me get our first phone call. This is Mike in Irondequoit. Go ahead, Mike.
It is great to hear the discussion. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mike.
My thinking is now I'm working on becoming older than dirt. And I can remember in, I think it was the early to mid-1950s, when Richard Nixon went over, he was vice president, went over to Moscow for the unveiling of a kitchen. And then it was called the Kitchen Debates. And Nikita Khrushchev boasted that what was then the USSR will overtake the United States without firing a shot. I think that to this country's misfortune, we seem to have an exceedingly short memory. People think we've won the Cold War, and I would suggest no, the Cold War is still in play. It has changed dramatically, and again, to our misfortune, we don't realize that, and we're beginning to see the effects. So I'll take the responses off the air. I thank you very, very much.
All right, Mike, thanks for the phone call. Are we still in a Cold War, and are we missing that? Dr. Stone, I'll start with you.
Well, I guess I tend to think of the Cold War as a particular historical period. I've taught courses about the Cold War, and so I had to pin down when it ended and so forth. Is there tension with Russia? Yes. Is there sort of continued potential for conflict? Yes. I think, unfortunately, because the current Russian administration insists on defining its interests in kind of an antiquated way that has to, that encourages them to engage in territorial disputes and so forth, which aren't really in Russia's long-term interests. But the Cold War was a special time in history when there was a global confrontation between two states that were vastly more powerful than any of the other states. It was militarized to an extraordinary degree. We were poised on a hair trigger to launch thousands of nuclear warheads at each other. There were numerous events, the most famous one, I think, involving a flock of geese, in which we came very close to going to war for no particular reason. It was a very dangerous time in human history. The situation now is much safer than it was then. When people talk about the current national security threats that the United States faces as being comparable in some sense to those of the Cold War, I think that it's a dangerous distortion.
But it doesn't mean there's no concern. I mean, Mike seems to be concerned with just because we closed the book on the Cold War that there's complacency.
Fair enough. I think it's more what American foreign policy is more likely to do than become complacent is to exaggerate threats.
Hmm.
Right. So when the Cold War was gone, we had to invent a new reason why we spent so much on the military and on the spying complex and so forth. And so we invented new threats to address. That's the more common temptation for a country to face that is so vastly more powerful than any conceivable coalition of opponents.
Along with potentially anachronistic military weaponry that we want to keep spending on that might require a justification of a threat. Possibly?
Well, we have a huge nuclear arsenal, which is aging. And one possibility is to dismantle much of it, and another possibility is to replace it with a huge additional investment. So how you analyze the threat scenarios is important to those sorts of budgetary decisions.
Mr. Golubevsky, what do you make of Mike's comments, his concern that we're still in the midst of a kind of a Cold War that has simply shifted?
Well, I agree with Professor Stone that we are, you know, the Russia now is not the Soviet Union of yesterday. Yet at the same time, and it still rings in my ears, a statement by President Putin that, you know, that the fall of the USSR was the largest tragedy of the 20th century for him. And and we have to remember that even Tsarist Russia and Imperial Russia was also a superpower, was also an expansionist imperial state. So I think it's not so much the case of the Soviet Union and Marxism, Leninism, and that type of ideological warfare that was going on with use of arms, but it's just a kind of a long history of imperialism that Russia has had under various guises that I think we should be aware of. I mean, that state has always considered its near abroad as a place where they can expand to. They've always been in competition with regional powers for land and for influence, including Poland, which used to hold an upper hand with vis-a-vis Russia. So, you know, for the country that's been on the ramparts, remembering the whole history of Russian influence in the region, you know, we have to remember that, you know, they are not yet willing to cross over completely to the so-called Western democratic side. I mean, you know, it's after all, we have to remember it's by majority an Asian country. It's a country which a lot of Russian citizens are Asians, are people who are not of European descent. And if you talk to Russians, you know, they tell you, look, we have a lot of Asian mentality in us. You know, we are not just Europeans. You know, and I think a lot of people in the West have this image of, you know, Russia as St. Petersburg, Tchaikovsky's, Dostoevsky's, and this kind of very pro-Western wing that sometimes dominates, well, try to dominate the intellectual milieu, but it's not really what Russia is. So I think, you know, I wouldn't say we have a Cold War. Obviously, the captive nations at least in Eastern Europe are not captive anymore, but we have to remember of imperialism and that tradition of imperialism that still threatens, I believe.
Here's a headline from the Toledo Blade last week. Polish lawed important trade partner, Ohio. And it was chronicling some of Mr. Golubiewski's travels and work that he's been doing. We're going to get our only break of the hour, and we're going to come back and talk trade. And we're going to talk about some of the work that he does as Consul General of the Republic of Poland in New York. Free trade and the future of free trade and the importance of these partnerships, particularly at this moment, you know, post-Brexit, post-election of Donald Trump, you know, that this moment where free trade feels certainly under assault in rhetoric, in the media, and in a lot of governments. So what's the future of these kind of relationships, and how does it impact us? How does it impact our relationships? We'll hit that and much more when we come back from our only break of the hour. Coming up in our second hour, we've got the people behind a new film called Fairhaven that was filmed right here in Rochester. It's about gay conversion therapy, and that is not a thing of the past. Conversion therapy still happens in a lot of different places, even though 5 states have already made it illegal. In some places, it's kind of gone underground. Well, the film explores the impact, the dangerous impact of conversion therapy, and a look at real love. That's next hour. Welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Maciej Golubiewski is the Consul General of the Republic of Poland in New York, and he is a guest of the University of Rochester today. Dr. Randy Stone is director of the Skolny Center for Polish and Central European Studies at the U of R, and they've got an exhibit that we're going to be telling you more about later in this hour that opens tonight. There's a panel discussion at 7:30 and then a reception, and I think a lot for us to learn and absorb. We'll get back to that coming up here. And we're also going to talk trade in just a moment, but Mike in Rochester, different Mike on the line, just wants to stay with some of the issues we've been hitting. So go ahead, Mike.
Hi, this is a great show.
Thanks.
I'm really enjoying it. Two questions. Number one, I wonder whether anyone on your panel or anyone there in the studio has imagined Donald Trump listening to this discussion and saying, boy, I didn't know that.
Well, he doesn't really do that, but well, it's a nice idea.
You get the idea, though.
Sure.
He doesn't have, not only does he not have any real knowledge of foreign policy, but he doesn't seem to be particularly interested in learning. That's number one. How does that affect all of the equations we're talking about, if it does? And number two, how does the presence of Steve Bannon there in the White House, someone who has definite predilections toward Russia, how does that affect these equations? What do the people there in the studio think of those two elements of them?
Mike, thank you for the questions. I mean, on the subject of a lack of intellectual curiosity, that probably just makes it more important than ever who you surround yourself with. And Randy Stone, he has surrounded himself with people who might have some competing views on the world. Steve Bannon does not see the world the same way Reince Priebus does not see the world the same way Rex Tillerson or General Mattis does, or others. What do you think?
Absolutely. That's a good point. He has surrounded himself with an incoherent group. And I can't imagine that this group continues to be in office throughout 4 years. They're going to be in conflict with each other on numerous things. On foreign policy, it looks like the change of national security advisor really shifts the balance pretty dramatically, so that now the people who are very skeptical of Russia have the upper hand. So it would be surprising to me if Steve Bannon were able to control that policy area. And I think his main interest seems to be on the domestic side, and at least in terms of what he's trying to push. He's pushing all sorts of things that I think are rather scary on the domestic side. But on, as far as foreign policy is concerned, it seems like there's been a bit of a normalization for now. But there's still this tension that there's this really extreme ideologue in Steve Bannon. And then there are some sort of traditional, on the hardline side, but there's some sort of traditional military advisors in the foreign policy establishment.
Mr. Golubevsky, anything you want to add to that?
Maybe a personal. This is my personal remark, not in the capacity as a consul general.
Sure.
The little I know about Steve Bannon and people that surround President Trump and their attitudes to Russia. One thing that always caught my attention is this idea of there is a bit of a culture warriorism, which is a part of what they talk about. I mean, I think a lot of people surrounding the president are fearful of the kind of the radical Islamic terrorism, right? And I think I think when they look at Russia, they look at the potential ally in that. You know, Russia is supporting openly supporting the Assad regime in Syria against the terrorists without equivocation, right? They really put a lot of those rebels in the same camp, and I think that fear, that concern with kind of radical terrorism of potential of some religious influence behind it, Muslim influence for what it, you know, and I and I know that it's controversial to say. I mean, because there's so many different versions. You pick sure. a religion, you have 15 theologies, but you know they are concerned with that. So I think a lot of those overtures to Russia are on the cultural front. And Putin has exploited it quite well. I think President Putin has exploited the idea that they are kind of a Christian rampart in that part of the world. I mean, there's, for example, in Georgia, he's been working with the Orthodox Church there to undermine Georgia's admission into NATO, into EU. So I think it's instrumental. I think it's serving a more mundane purpose for President Putin. But I think a lot of social conservatives and conservatives that are on the cultural side notice that. And they consider Russia as a kind of a cultural ally, but that does not necessarily translate into security considerations and kind of, you know, on the international relations side. So maybe that's the tension.
A question about Poland and relationships and views toward Poland comes from Hal in Geneseo. Go ahead, Hal.
Hi. Yes, thank you. I've been visiting Germany for over 50 years, and since some of my relatives lived through their own World War II as Germans, I've always wondered and learned a kind of a German-American world view of European history and politics. And so where I'm going with this is recently I've been reading two books by Professor Timothy Snyder. One I think I found in the Geneseo College Library called Bloodlands Between Stalin and Hitler, and the sequel is related. They're revelations that I never heard years ago about the experiences of Poland and other Eastern European countries that were so not just the more familiar outline of the Holocaust, but the starvation and intentional starvation by Stalin of the Ukraine and to some extent Poland. I guess the question I'm getting to, another movie I just saw recently is called Innocence, and that's kind of gets at the heart of the question, which is in that movie, Polish nuns are first obviously the areas occupied by the Nazis and then by the Soviets. Only when the Soviets came, they in fact raped and impregnated all these nuns. So it was quite a... In other words, Poland has had such a difficult time over perhaps hundreds of years, not knowing the history well. How can Americans better understand the post-World War and post-Cold War Poland in some kind of outline, since we really, many of us, were raised on kind of a Western European view of the history of Europe?
Thank you, Hal. Go ahead.
No, thank you very much for this question. It's really a challenge for me to do exactly what you just asked.
We need another hour.
Yes. No. But it's my job. It's the job of the consulates to do those public diplomacy campaigns. We're organizing lectures. We're bringing in exhibitions like this one to many places around the United States. We talk about the Polish underground, the soldiers that fought with communists in the 40s and 50s. Up until 1963, there was an underground anti-communist movement, armed movement that very few people know about. We talk about, there's a lot of just new history coming out. There's an Institute for Historical Remembrance. It's a Polish institute that's been active for past 15 years or so. It's also doing a lot of cutting edge research. As I said before, it's only recently really where Poles re-engage again with their history after so many falsehoods, lies, and communist propaganda, and then focusing on kind of the economics and business side of things. You know, Poles are now trying to recover those great elements and sad ones also. I mean, the fact that the communism killed over 100 million people, is a very unknown fact. The fact that communists in Poland and in communist Russia killed their own citizens, not on the basis of ethnicity, but because of the amount of money they had, or because of the amount of ideologies they had, or whatever they believed, was, you know, something that still needs a lot of education. Timothy Snyder, Professor Timothy Snyder, whom I know, whom I met a few times, is doing an absolutely great job. He's a professor at Yale University. He's done cutting-edge research on showing that type of horror. And actually, I'm looking forward to working with him if he's in New Haven. But if he's listening, or somebody who knows him is listening, I'm already would like to invite him over to the consulate for a lecture and for some sort of event that will talk about those events. It's just, you know, it's just a lot of work to be done in public diplomacy for us.
Maciej, some of the work that you're doing is traveling to places like Ohio. And again, you were there recently talking trade, talking about the value among both partners here, even in the midst of this moment of sort of anti-globalism, anti-free trade rhetoric. Is that rhetoric, do you find that to be kind of closing in? Are we entering a more protectionist age? Or do you think that this is just sort of a moment? And, you know, what are your concerns or thoughts about that?
Well, I'm not a trade economist, even though I did work a little bit in trade at some point in my life. I think, look, on the, you know, there's big trade, there's multilateral trade, yeah. there's WTO, there are big trade agreements between blocs, EU is a customs union, these are the big topics, and I think it's the kind of the big trade agenda that's in the news. But you know, trade is also relationships, personal relationships between businesses, between states even, and Poland or regions in Poland. And, you know, when I was in Ohio, you know, we're trying to focus on opportunities for businessmen locally there and in Poland. I think President Trump's ambition for U.S. is similar to the to the Polish ambition. Is we want to make sure the jobs are created at home. We're interested in investment, in high value added investment. Poland is also not interested in importing cheap assembly plants to Poland. We want R&D. We want research collaboration. We want businesses who want to engage in this type of more ambitious trade relationship. So I think there's plenty of work that can be done that's mutually beneficial, notwithstanding the kind of the big trade agenda and talks of fair trade. We can have fair trade, but we can still engage in a lot of profitable relationships. I mean, with Ohio, we are thinking about organizing a follow-up trade missions. We think the costs of doing business at Ohio are great. There are business accelerators that would welcome Polish firms for a few months to do business there. We have a great collaboration with the state of Nevada. We just discussed with the University of Rochester, and then, you know, there's maybe a possibility of doing something with this part of New York State on business relationships, investment, and trade. You know, so I think, look, depends on what level you talk.
Okay. Dr. Stone, I know you've expressed some concern about some of the rhetoric during the campaign and how it's playing out. Has mm-hmm. that changed at all for you now, or is that more severe?
Well, I think that the new administration has put the brakes on all of our multilateral trade diplomacy and decided that, you know, this whole agenda is simply not going to move forward for the next few years. There's also the question of whether NAFTA will in fact be terminated or renegotiated, which could be tremendously disruptive to the United States economy, as well as to those of our closest neighbors. The thing is that tariffs are extraordinarily low right now. The story about trade is non-tariff barriers, right? That crop up constantly. Mm-hmm. Everyone is constantly innovating ways of distorting trade flows to the advantage of some interest group and the disadvantage of foreign competitors. The United States doesn't do that very much. We're not very effective at this sort of thing. And so if we leave the trade field and just don't work at it for a while, it will gradually become less and less friendly to American businesses. And foreign countries will figure out ways to discriminate against American products. So this will be to our disadvantage. So I think the next president is going to have to reengage in the trade agenda and is going to have a lot of makeup to do.
All right, we've got to keep the final comments really tight because we're running out of time. Carlo in Union Springs, try to do it in 20 or 30 seconds. Go ahead, sir.
Okay, thanks. I was returning to the Putin question because I think the Cold War, that's an oversimplification. He, to me, seems like a hybrid of the traditional Russian czars and people like Milosevic and his own little part of it. And I think they are probing. I think they'll end up keeping the Crimea. Full of Russians and let Ukraine like work itself out. I also think they're probing the Baltic states' airspace, and they're trying to figure out how long before they get a response. That's how you work out a plan. So it's scary, and I'm not sure what's going to happen. And I will take your answer.
Well,
thank you,
Carl. I think that lines up with a lot of what Professor Stone was saying earlier this hour. Kind of probing around a little more adventurous, seeing what you can get away with. What do you think, Randy?
Yeah, I don't think that Putin has a long-term plan. I think he stumbles from one crisis to the next. I don't think that he intended to provoke a major crisis in Ukraine when he put the brakes on Ukraine's negotiations with the European Union over a trade agreement. But things spun out of control. And then he responded from one crisis to the next by escalating and escalating and escalating. The concern is that he may feel that there's some reason for him to escalate once again, right? We hope that NATO gets its act together sufficiently that doesn't look like an attractive thing to do. We hope that some kind of a deal can be brokered. But the two sides in Ukraine are very, very far apart, and they don't seem to be making any progress. So if Putin feels urgency about this, then that has all the ingredients for a crisis.
Danielle in Brighton writes to say, her parents are Holocaust survivors, and last summer she visited a mansion in Poland that her family had built. And she wants to know how she can get in touch with the Consul General to talk more about it or ask you some questions.
Sure. We have a very good website. Go on Google and do Consulate General of Poland in New York. You'll get to our site. You get all the contacts, telephone numbers, emails. Email the secretariat with your concern, and we'll get back to you.
All right, Daniel. Thank you for that. And Randy Stone, let us know again what happens tonight at 7:30.
So tonight at 7:30, we were having about a one-hour discussion, including questions and answers, with Maciej Gołębiewski, the Consul General, and a panel of experts on that will open the exhibition, and then there will be a reception and viewing of the exhibition. So the panel is in Morey Hall, and the exhibition is in Rettner Hall right next door. And parking at the University of Rochester is free after 7 o'clock.
That's nice to always have to mention that. That's very good. Tonight at 7:30, and I want to thank both of our guests for being here. The Consul General of the Republic of Poland in New York is Maciej Galubiewski, who's been generous with his time. And I wish we had more, but thank you, sir. Safe travels, and I look forward to future conversations.
Me too. Thank you so much. And I'm looking forward to being here again.
Professor Stone, always a good conversation with you, and thanks. We'll talk to you again soon.
My pleasure. Thanks, Evan.
All right. Thanks to all of the feedback, and we had more calls and comments we couldn't even get to, but that just means tonight you've got a chance to continue that conversation and learn more at 7:30. Let's get a short break, and more Connections is next.